from WBUR Boston. I'm Tom Ashbrook, and this is On Point. This last year has been the hottest on record in the United States. Now, more than half the country is in drought. The West knows it from fire, wildfire, Texas from parched rangeland. Now, drought is hitting hard in the country's agricultural heartland, the Corn Belt. It's bad. It's hitting crops and farmers now. It will hit you at the grocery store soon enough. It's making people wonder about the weather and the climate. This hour on Point, the nation's great drought of 2012. And you can comment at our website, onpointradio.org, or on Twitter and Facebook at On Point Radio. Voices from across the Midwest and beyond raised in the last days as the drought just got worse. Here on the edge of it, Iowa farmer Andy Hall is struggling to hang on with no rain in sight.
We're just on life support day to day. If we can get the tenth of an inch rain here, a half inch there, it just prolongs things another day before we have a disaster.
Might just prolong. Other places, it's already tipped. It's already gone. The crop not going to happen in anything like the way it ought to. And that also affecting folks raising livestock here. Atkins, Arkansas rancher Karen Harrelson spoke with NBC's Jane Shamlin about the daily struggle to feed her cattle with skyrocketing grain prices and bone-dry grazing land.
It's just devastating. It is. It looks like what I count the desert.
Harrelson has sold off 100 of her 250-head herd because she can't afford to feed them. The most severe drought in the state's history could soon claim her livelihood of three decades.
If no significant rain comes, I'll have to go out of business.
It's bad. Here's Mountain Grove, Missouri farmer Duncan Smith. He's been raising cattle on his land for 25 years, and over time he's seen ups and downs in the weather.
We're going in a three-year cycle. 03 was bad. 06 was worse. 09 was suicide watch, and now we are in 2012, and I've got friends. I don't know whether to jump with them or talk them down.
To jump with them or talk them down, it is bad. Maybe the worst in about half a century right now out there. We'll talk in this hour to a corn farmer in Illinois, a cattle rancher in Nebraska, a drought and climate expert. But joining us first today from West Lafayette, Indiana, is Christopher Hart. He's professor of agricultural economics at Purdue University. Chris Hart, welcome to On Point. Thanks so much for being with us.
It's my pleasure.
I'm sorry it's so bad out there. Talking with my dad in central Illinois last night, he's 80 years old, and he said he has never seen himself anything like the fields he was driving through. He said it really, really shook him to see just how bad it is. No kernels on what little stumps of ears of corn there are.
Well, that's right, Tom. We are seeing Illinois, one of the heaviest affected states. USDA does crop ratings each Monday, releases those each Monday. They were showing 26% of Illinois' crop, our second biggest corn state, that was in the very worst conditions, very poor. Now, as analysts, we generally consider that to be nearly gone. I think that's what your dad's reflecting.
Mm-hmm.
But this is broader than Illinois. We've got a number of states that are 20 to as much as 40% rated in the very worst possible conditions. We can start on the east side of the Corn Belt, Ohio, Kentucky, Indiana, Michigan, Illinois, of course, as we mentioned, Missouri, and Wisconsin. Then we get to Iowa, Nebraska. They're not quite as bad yet. We've got about 10% of that crop at this point that's in the very worst case. So I think you're right. We're hearing farmers, and including my own family farm in Illinois,
mm-hmm.
where we're talking about no corn yield this year at all.
Just unbelievable. My family's farm there on the little Kickapoo Creek, the creek itself almost gone, and the corn not right at all. And the timing of the worst of the heat and the dry really matters here this year, as you well know, Chris. It's just at the time when that corn ought to be pollinated. Tassels come out, it's time to pollinate and get some ears of corn growing, and that is not happening in this heat.
No, that's right. And again, corn only in any given field only pollinates reproduction about 5 to 7 days. We saw a lot of that corn pollinating, as you said, in central Illinois, trying to pollinate the July 4th mm-hmm. week. We're finishing now pollination in the northern third of the Corn Belt. Nationally, we're about 71% pollinated, but now we have Iowa, northern Iowa temperatures in triple digits right now. And with weather stress, I think we really are greatly concerned that this is epic proportions, and 1988's the one we're looking back to, but my projections have this over the next 2 weeks, actually conditions falling below 1988. We're talking one of the worst, perhaps two, three droughts in a century.
We see the chief economist at the U.S. Agriculture Department, Joe Glauber, saying this drought could get a lot worse before it gets better. Soybeans, a big deal here as well. They're a little more durable in these conditions, but vulnerable as well. What about beans?
Well, yeah, beans do have a different physiology. They do not pollinate as a short period, but they actually pollinate over about 4 to 6 weeks. In the prime Midwest growing areas, that's generally the last half of July, which we've now entered, and into most of August. And soybeans do have an ability with that long pollination period to maybe have 2 or 3 weeks of stress and then have some recovery. Now, again, even up until this week, I think we were hopeful that if this weather could change, that we could see maybe fairly substantial recovery in bean yields. But our two-week-out forecasts look just like continuation of what we've had. And I think that's now saying that corn probably is headed over a cliff with regard to yields. It just can't recover. And soybeans are going to be there in another 2 weeks.
Corn headed over a cliff.
We're very nervous.
Wow, that is quite a sentence. I mean, that is the biggest crop in the United States. Chris Hurd, stand by there at Purdue. It's great to have you with us in Indiana. I want to get right into southern Illinois, where it's been really bad. Don Duvall joins us from Carmi, Illinois. Farmer, president of the White County Farm Bureau there. He's been farming 40 years, owns a lot of land there. He's 60 now, maybe, and leases a lot of it out. Done a lot of active farming himself over the years. Don Duvall in Carmi, thank you very much for joining us today.
It's my pleasure, Tom.
So in your experience, what do you make of this summer? Have you seen one like it before, Don?
I think Chris was to the point when he said this is probably the worst. He referred, I think, to his 80-year-old father, and I would concur with that.
That's my dad, who's 80, and say,
yeah,
absolutely. Yeah, up in Bloomington.
You're right. Well, we're about 4 hours south of that, mm-hmm. and that part of the state, the southern part of the state, is probably hit harder than Bloomington.
Mm-hmm.
So I would concur with your father that this is the worst that I have seen in my farming career.
You are actually mowing down corn on your land right here in the middle of the season now. Why?
Well, that's correct, because there was no possibility of that corn producing anything. There was no ear there to pollinate. And there was really no point in leaving the plant there to take the nutrients up with no possibility of producing a kernel. So it was decided to mow it down, and then if we did get a rain, you could replant to soybeans.
Have you ever done that or seen that done in your long farming career before, Don?
I have never done that, nor have I seen it done. I think I have seen it this dry before.
Mm-hmm.
But it was much later in the season when it was not as critical in that pollination time frame. So it shaved yield off of the corn. It did not eliminate it, which is what's occurred this year in many places.
You've been quoted saying that this year it all went quickly from ideal to tragic. Has it given you a sense of, I mean, normally nature works it out pretty well and the corn will hang in there and it'll work hard to come through, but it has given you a sense, Don, of how fragile things can be if the wrong weather hits at the wrong time.
That's exactly right. We did start the season especially early, which was for an optimum yield.
Because of the warmer winter and spring, was that, or why?
That's correct.
Mm-hmm.
The conditions were perfect very early in the season. We got good stands. Everything looked ideal, but then it just stopped raining. We literally had about a 6 week period the entire month of June with absolutely no precipitation whatsoever. Here in southern Illinois, we're probably 10 inches to a foot below normal, what our normal precipitation is, and obviously a corn plant cannot survive that.
You've got people saying, I mean, looking at the facts of this as a drought, you've got others saying, you know what, this is more than a drought. This is fundamental change, and we may see this area becoming more arid, just simply more arid. They say you don't call the Sahara Desert in a drought. You call it a desert. when you sit back with all your years on this land, Don, do you worry about the bigger climate picture, or do you just see this as a cycle?
Well, I think, you know, 40 years in farming is really a very small window to be making a climatic prediction on. So I see it more as just a seasonal thing. I will also say that my comments are buoyed by a we got a 1-inch rain this past Sunday night. So
good for you.
It makes me think that life will go on. It certainly improved our soybean chances. So I am not that pessimistic to think that we will now be living in a desert. So I think the Corn Belt is here to stay for a while, and I'm not concerned about that climatic change, I guess you'd say.
But your corn yield this year compared to last, what are you predicting at this point?
You know, here in southern Illinois, we have such varying soil types that it's very difficult to make a prediction for the entire area. Certainly there are sandy soils, higher soils with very poor water-holding capacity, that the yield will be zero. We have quite a bit of that. We also have some ground under irrigation and then some soils that are better water-holding capacity. They will, too, be impacted, but there will still be a crop. Uneducated guess would be we're probably going to see about a 40 to 50% of a normal crop for the entire county.
That is a big, big thing to say. Don Duval in Carmi, Illinois, farming there. Thank you very much for being with us, Don. Chris Hurt at Purdue, please stand by. We're talking about drought in the nation's breadbasket. I'm Tom Ashbrook. This is On Point. We'll be right back. Here's Kansas farmer Jay Armstrong talked with Fox Business' Melissa Francis about how his farm in Muscoda, Kansas, has survived the last four decades.
In my lifetime, Melissa, I started farming in 75. I remember the 100-degree days of 1980. I remember the drought of 88 that was a nationwide drought. And, of course, this one will now be in the memory banks as the year I should have just took a leave of absence.
Should have just taken a leave of absence, but a lot of people cannot walk away. We've got feedback here. Nick writes to us on Facebook. Says, crops are burning up here in southwestern Iowa, and we churn out more greenhouse gases than ever trying to get water to them. Nick writes, something has to give. Well, we'll see here. Christopher Hurt joins us from West Lafayette, Indiana. He's professor of agricultural economics at Purdue University. It's great to have you with us, Chris. We've got a lot more we want to look at on the economic side of this. I want to hear from another guy who's out there trying to make it work. Right now, joining us from Nebraska, Hyannis, Nebraska, no less, is Al Davis. He's owner of the OLO Ranch cattle operation, 2,200 head of cattle, pretty good-sized operation. Al, thanks a lot for joining us.
Thank you, Tom. It's just as bad as all the other folks have said it is. It's terrible.
How's it hitting you, Al? What are the conditions you're looking at there?
We had a very mild winter. Was very. I should say, first of all, when people talk about a desert, and we live in really what is a desert. It's the Nebraska sand hills.
Right.
Most of our rain comes in the spring, and so if you look at the Nebraska sand hills, it looks just like the Sahara Desert with grass on it. And interspersed between those dunes are sub-irrigated meadows. The sand really soaks up the water, which is a good thing. So in many years, we're able to eke it out, even if it's tough. But, you know, I'm going to say we probably get about 15 inches of rain a year.
Mm-hmm.
This year so far, you know, we're way down in the probably 4 level. And I know early on this year, the creeks were just starting to dry up. And those creeks are just groundwater, basically, that's running out of the sandhills. So very serious here.
What does it mean for your herd? We've seen a lot of people having to sell it off because they can't afford to feed it. Are you selling off some of your herd, Al, to just keep everything floating?
Well, you know, what we do is we farm grass. That's what a rancher really does. He takes grass and harvests that and turns it into a product. So
beef.
You know, if you don't have any grass, you have to remove animals from your ranch. It's the only solution that's out there. At our operation, we carry our calves, which normally are weaned on a lot of ranches in the fall. We carry those over for another year,
right,
and sell them as yearlings. So, you know, that normally takes place at our place in September. This year in June, I decided it was time to get them off. So we put them in the feedlot, and then I normally have some fall cows here that I keep, and I sold those. We sold 400 of those. So we've taken a third of the animals off the place. But you know, there just was no summer. There were warm season and cool season grasses. The warm season grasses just never came on.
So
you get out in the pasture, it looks like a table, a bare table.
So are you letting some of those calves go? You're not going to keep them on into yearlings? You're not going to beef them up?
No, we're not going to be able to do that. That'll be the next step, will be to wean the calves and take them off the ranch. And then hopefully, you know, you'll have enough forage to keep the cows going. We produce a lot of hay. We produce about 10,000 bales of hay normally. This year we're probably going to be lucky if we have 3,500. That's our winter feed.
Chris Hurt there at Purdue, what if farmers are mowing down their corn, can they turn it into silage and ship it out to Al Davis to feed his cattle that need it?
Well, there certainly is a lot of effort being put in by the land-grant universities and others to try to help farmers. One of the difficulties we have is that corn supply tends not to be where the cattle are. And actually shipping forages like that, it would be very expensive. And so, yes, we're trying to link up cattle feeders, cattle people with some of this corn that's being destroyed. But a lot of transportation issues, and we just don't have a system that's largely set up for that. The corn's one place, and the cattle are another place is kind of the problem.
So Al Davis, there in Nebraska, how do you think about it? How do old-timers think about it? I mean, it's not the first drought by any means, but it's a bad one, maybe the worst since the 50s, some are saying now. Others look all the way back to the 30s. Some say, you know, worst conditions for some crops in a century. What does that leave you thinking about viability? You're always in Nebraska kind of on the edge there, but this is edgy, way edgier than usual.
I'm very concerned about it. You know, a 1 year episode we can handle, and a 2 year episode will start to deteriorate the soil, and if it goes on for any longer than that, the grass will just certainly die, and then the sand will start moving again. You know, there are historical records that has happened several times in the Nebraska area over the last 2,000 years, so we could be approaching that again. I pray that we aren't.
Yes, we all do. Let's get some callers in here, if I may. Robert's calling from Charlestown, Rhode Island. Robert, thanks for calling. You're on the air.
Hi, Tom. Yes, I am in Charlestown, and we're on the way to one of the hottest summers. I think this is the fourth hottest summer in a row and fifth hottest summer in a row. And listening to this, I'm wondering, what are people's feelings? Is it time to think about global warming? I worked on a farm, and the diesel from the tractors is a contributor to the greenhouse gases. And I'm wondering what it's going to take to get us to realize that it's time to make this transformation, until we're looking at things like creating deserts with our activities. And then what are we going to do, look back and say, oh, I guess that wasn't such a good idea?
Al Davis in Nebraska, what do you make of that perspective? Is it on your mind?
You know, I don't think we have enough information on global warming to say that really is definitely going on. And you got to go back 1,000 years, and you find, you know, Greenland was very warm. People were living there. And so, you know, the Earth has natural cycles. The jury, in my mind, is still out on that. And I worry about it, but I think we've just got to have more information first.
Al, I appreciate you spending a few minutes with us there from your OLO ranch in Hyannis, Nebraska, and I wish you good luck in this dry season, and thank you for your time, Al.
Thank you.
Let's get another voice in here from Nebraska on this front of weather and climate. Mark Svoboda joins us. He's a climatologist at the University of Nebraska in Lincoln. He's the monitoring program area leader for the National Drought Mitigation Center, monitors drought conditions in collaboration with the U.S. government. Mark, thanks very much for joining us today.
Hi, Tom.
So you hear our caller. You know, he looks out at our fossil fuel-driven economy and worries that we're creating the conditions we're living with. Even farmers and their diesel tractors may be part of it. You hear our rancher, Al, who says he's concerned about it, but he's still thinking natural cycles. How do you see it, Mark?
Well, we can look back even in recent history in the 30s and see a much more persistent, nearly decade-long heat signature associated with drought. The mid-50s were a multi-year drought, and while this drought is hitting in an inopportune time and position in our breadbasket, It's not as long-lived as what Mother Nature can show us in the normal realm of variability. That said, the difference is the drastic increase in gases in the atmosphere is at a rate we have never seen. We have data that go back a long ways for that, and so I think the evidence does show that if that happens and we do have a warmer atmosphere to contend with in the future, that maybe droughts become a more persistent nemesis, if you will, in a future changing climate.
So there's that maybe in a future changing climate, but there's a real fear attached to that. Chris, it's making farmers hurt right now, but this will show up on supermarket shelves. I mean, this is going to hit everybody, really, in food prices sooner or later. How do you figure that will filter through, Chris Hurt?
Yeah, that's right. We're going to have long tentacles and major ripple effects, and it will affect all of us, certainly on the food price side. Just talk about that a second. You know, the first things we see are the higher grain prices. For example, wheat prices are up about 35% since we got into this drought. That relates directly to, obviously, bread and bakery products. Cereals from oats, wheat, corn, and other grains were up 35 to 50%. Corn's up about 50%. So those prices will fairly quickly get into our cereal. And when I'm talking fairly quickly, I think late summer we will see those price increases. In terms of vegetable oils, soybean oil is our largest vegetable oil source. That relates to cooking oils, margarine, and salad dressings. And then sweeteners. I think we hear that corn, in one way or another, is involved in something over half of the products in the grocery store, and I should say the food products in the grocery store, and high-fructose corn syrup. So that 50% rise in corn prices will be reflected in higher sweeteners that we see not only in our soda pops, but also in a lot of the processed foods that we buy. Longer term, these are going to happen late this summer and into this fall. Longer term, the meat sector, which we've already heard about from Nebraska, the immediate thing that happens for the animal producers is it raises the cost of feed dramatically. Corn, soybean meal, the base of the feed, they cannot pass that on to consumers in the short run. So as we've already heard from Nebraska, start the liquidation of cattle and hog herds as well as the flocks, and that liquidation will occur really into this fall. That means less supply of meats, milk products, and eggs in 2013. So that's where we'll see the big rise in those items related to animals.
Because they'll be thinning their herds and flocks this year, and next. So you might even see, could you see a dip in meat prices this year, but then up next year when they deal with the other side of that?
Well, we generally have record high prices, particularly on beef and pork, and actually on cattle. We could see enough liquidation, I think, this fall as they just simply run out of feed to feed them. And really a year or more of very depressed prices, and not prices so much, but feed costs so high they're going to lose money. So that liquidation on beef could actually cause a moderate decrease at the grocery store, but it's not going to be very much. And then we are just simply going to take off on beef prices and pork prices next year. Unfortunately for beef, we'll be projecting record high beef prices every year through 2015. We really can't increase now the amount of beef in the United States until 2016.
Listeners, are you hearing this? We're talking about liquidation of livestock. And on the other side of that, Chris, you're an economist. How does it look? How does it factor into inflation overall? Is there enough of a bump here in food prices down the road that it's likely to hit the overall inflation rate in this country?
Well, sure. It's going to push up food inflation. And food inflation has already been relatively high, and when we say high, higher than the general inflation rate, and unfortunately higher than our rate of income increases in our paychecks on average. We were 3.7% food inflation in 2011. This year we're estimating now around 3.5%, and I think probably at that 3% range and maybe a little more next year. So there's a three-year time window, 11, 12, 13, food prices up something in the range of 10%, and our paychecks have not been. The bottom line is food's a necessity. Food extracts more of our disposable income. That's less dollars to be spent for other things, and that probably even has a touch of slowing for the general economy. Now, again, and we'd think that would be fairly modest in the tenths of a percent, but it's not a positive for our general economy going forward either.
We're hearing from listeners all over on the hot and the dry. Cynthia writes, we've been feeling the heat here in Colorado, so thankful to finally see rain clouds instead of smoke plumes on the horizon. Of course, a lot of wild, epic wildfires there. Krista in Berkshire, Vermont. Krista, thanks for calling. You're on the air.
Yes. Hi, Tom.
Hi.
I've noticed, and we have about an 80-some acre pine forest, white pines and red pines, and this is the first year that we have absolutely no pine cones. Normally, we have piles and piles of pine cones that the squirrels eat, and the squirrels are right now going crazy. They're attacking everything that they can eat. There are no pine cones, and I do believe in global warming because I see it. We grow all of our own food, and it's so hard to grow it outside anymore. We had to put it in a greenhouse. But the thing I wanted to speak about is no pine cones. I mean, there is something going on in the environment, and I attribute it to the quick changes of hot to cold. And you get the frost at the wrong times, like we have no apples up here. You have no pine cones, and the animals will suffer just as much as we will in the end.
Krista, I appreciate your report on that. You put us right there in your backyard, and I appreciate it. Mark, talk to us about the range of drought here. Just geographically, where's the heart of this? What's the reach of it? Paint a picture for us.
Well, certainly from a spatial extent standpoint, it's the largest spatial extent we have seen since the 30s and the 50s. That's when you saw over 60% of the country in some form of drought. Now, the intensity pockets vary. We've had that initial epicenter that persists in Texas, which affected cattle last year, and the southeast in Georgia, Alabama. Mm-hmm. They're into a multi-year drought. In the west, we saw very low snowpacks this year. We saw the fires early on this summer to midsummer. So you've got a pocket there. And then you move to the east, you've got this pocket that runs from Arkansas up through Illinois and into Indiana. That's another severe pocket that's affecting some of the grain belt. So that's where we sit historically, one of the top three largest spatial extents in the last 100 years.
A lot of people are looking forward, hoping for some rain here. But what's being projected? The projections don't look so great.
Well, in the short term, as we heard earlier, the next 2 to 4 weeks look pretty dire, unfortunately. The heat is building back in. The prospects for rain are slim. We have high pressure dominating, which tends to push the rain up into Canada with the displaced jet stream to the north. Unless we have some sort of a freak tropical storm work its way up the Gulf and push itself well up into the Midwest, which can happen, that would be welcomed rain, but the odds aren't good for that. And hopefully some silver lining in the cloud is a longer-term picture with a shift from La Nina the last two winters to El Nino, which is warmer sea surface temperatures in the equatorial Pacific. That puts more moisture up in the atmosphere, which is a conveyor belt into the U.S. Let's see if that changes our fortunes this coming winter, because the models right now are showing a pretty good consensus of giving us better odds of going into El Nino this coming winter.
I'm Tom Ashbrook. This is On Point. We're talking this hour about the nation's great drought. More than half the country now hit, from California to the cornfields of the Midwest and beyond. Here's Illinois Governor Pat Quinn speaking yesterday in Mount Vernon, Illinois, talking about the persistent drought that's plagued farmlands across the state and the country.
We've got to be on the front line with all of our farmers across Illinois, that this is their hour of need, and we will not forget them. We must work together and band together in the best traditions of Abraham Lincoln's government of the people.
And here with the governor, Philip Nelson, president of the Illinois Farm Bureau, talking about the important role of the state and the health of the nation's agriculture, saying a little bit of let's pray.
Most of you know that Illinois produces roughly 20% of this nation's corn crop, about 15% of this nation's soybean crop. So we're all very concerned at what will happen in the next couple weeks. hoping and praying for rain to turn around this situation.
A couple of voices there from Illinois. We've got response from all over the country here out in Washington State, eastern Washington State. Charles writes us, he's out in soft white wheat country. He says they've had the opposite, unseasonable repeating storm, central Walla Walla County, a disaster area. Too much rain, roads washed out, bridge washed out. You know, he says the Pacific Northwest may be experiencing normal heat, but unusual weather. Mark, I guess your eye is just on the drop, but does it make flip sides in other parts of the country? Are they related?
Well, it does. There's the haves and the have-nots. The displacement of the jet stream to the north, the tracking of the storms, if you will, have been pushed and displaced to the north across sort of the entire U.S.-Canadian border all the way into the New England region from Washington eastward. So we have seen that pattern this summer.
And Chris, here's a listener who asks us to look at the relationship between the vulnerability to drought and food policies that support or encourage monocultures in general, and king corn, our listener writes, in particular. What about that, Chris?
Well, there's obviously questions. We have in the Midwest primarily gotten into a two-crop rotation. That's corn and soybeans, mm-hmm. a little bit of wheat mixed in with that. We also, the question was about policy. We do have an ethanol policy, which does help stimulate more and more monoculture towards corn. And in Indiana, as an example, if you take corn and soybeans, we're 55% of our acreage is in corn this year, 45% in soybeans. So we're moving away from two crops to even one crop. I think there's still a lot of unanswered questions about that, but I think his comment does suggest that there are vulnerabilities that science needs to continue to study.
Hey, Mark, when you look forward here, we know what the sort of central agricultural region has looked like in this country. There's all kinds, but in the middle of the country. Does it change? Does it move? Does it migrate with climate changes over time? Do we see it move north? Does the south become too hot and dry for what we've seen? Does it move east? Does that western boundary become too arid? Are you making that kind of projection?
Well, yeah, I think that is a natural progression or conclusion, if you will. You saw even earlier this year the release of the new plant hardiness zones, and these shifts have occurred over time. I mean, we've seen drastic changes just on our continent alone, but this is the case for all continents with the changing climate. Looking at it from a much longer historical perspective, certainly not in our lifetimes, but on a geological time mm-hmm. scale of millennia, and looking at millions of years, these shifts have occurred through time. So they will continue to do so in the future.
If we've got a more volatile climate now, is it possible that may happen on a faster time scale? Will the Corn Belt be somewhere else in, I don't know, 30, 40 years?
Well, I think that's a great question. I think that's what we're looking at maybe from a climate change signature isn't the change or shift. That's happened before. It's the rate of change and how quickly that may flip-flop on us. And this roller coaster of variability seems to be going into double loops right now instead of just going up and down. So I think that is another good point to consider as we move forward here in the next few decades.
Let's go to Pat in Sharon, Massachusetts. Pat, thanks for calling. You're on the air.
Hi, Tom. How are you?
Real well, Pat. I've got enough to drink here right now. Unfortunately, the corn at home doesn't. What do you think?
Well, first of all, in Sharon and in southern Massachusetts, I think we're going to break records today. We'll probably mm-hmm. get – the record was set, I think, in 1999 to be 98. I think we're going to hit about 100. And it's what I just read in the paper today, it's been the warmest January through June since records been keeping since 1895 or something like that.
So you're hot too. So what do you think?
We're very hot, and I do not have air.
Mm-hmm.
So I'm sitting by a fan. What I wanted to say was that I wanted to talk to you about the correlation between what happened in the 30s and what happens today. That was 80 years ago. Interestingly, we had the Great Depression in the 30s, and we had the Great Recession today.
Yeah.
We have the Great Dust Bowl of the 30s, and now we're getting a Dust Bowl today. And also, I believe, as a real environmentalist who really tries to do everything she can to be as green as possible,
yeah.
to say that our global warming didn't start in the 20th century. It probably started back in the Industrial Revolution.
Mm-hmm.
And so I would like to have a comment about that, about what how long it takes. And I understand that there's, you know, there's cycles and all this other stuff.
Yep.
But that's about a 300 or 400-year cycle. And well, we've now also seen an 80-year cycle. And is there any correlation between recession, depression, and drought and drought?
Well, Mark, there's a lot to chew on. I mean, jump in wherever you want. Think about trend lines with Pat for a second, Mark. What do you think?
Wow, that is a lot. I'm just bouncing around in my head right now. Unfortunately, I don't have an answer to the first part of that statement with regards to how long would it take. Sort of looking at the latter part of framing that question, I think when you look at past, there's been some research done on it. I personally haven't done it that concluded the Depression wasn't necessarily a direct result of the Dust Bowl years or the drought. Although the timing was not good. In the past, people picked up and moved. If you look back to the indigenous people, they had that luxury. People are pretty bunkered down, if you will, nowadays. You can't just pick up and move or take your cars out of Oklahoma and go west. Things have changed quite a bit. So I think the rules of the game have changed quite a bit as well.
1930s had several years of drought, and we got a Dust Bowl.
Yeah.
Do we have a Dust Bowl now? I mean, we've been talking about drought in Texas, Oklahoma for some time now. Do we have a Dust Bowl now?
Or, I wouldn't say we have a Dust Bowl exactly. I mean, we do have some occasional dust storms. Remember, out of the 30s, the Soil Conservation Service was born to work with producers, extension with university to work with producers, and they've done a great job over the last several decades putting into place much more environmentally friendly land management practices to prevent soil erosion via water and or air. So we're not displacing that soil like they did, tilling it up for full exposure back in the Dust Bowl years of the 30s. So times have changed with technology, keeping the residue on there to capture as much moisture as they can. Keep that in the soil. Don't turn it over. And that has made a huge difference. But that said, you know, we saw in 2002 the drought in Montana. We saw it last year in Oklahoma and Texas and the panhandles of those two states respectively. In places, it looked like Mars out there. So if you go dry for a 10, 15, 20-year period overall, you know, we heard the gentleman mention, Al, about the dunes in western Nebraska.
Mm-hmm.
You know, those could migrate. So these are things from a long-term perspective. I think the jury's still out.
Chris, you are our ag economist here. You can hear everybody ruminating on what's going on and kind of trying to figure it out. Is this just a cycle? Is this climate change? If it's climate change, could it actually move ag regions over time? I mean, here's a hammer coming down right in the middle of the season in a really bad way. It's hurting a lot of farmers deeply. Got one listener who writes to us says, hey, now that the real money in the Corn Belt is involved, the reality of global warming will slowly start to dawn. So introduce a dollar sign and brains gain a little traction. He's got a political spin on that. But what about it, Chris? Do you see people who are setting policy, who are making investments, who are in charge or on the front line beginning to scratch their head and say, maybe we do have to think in bigger terms to protect our livelihoods and our food supply, for that matter?
Well, there's certainly the old saying, the proof is in the pudding. And when you go through a situation that we are going through this year, it does cause, I think, everybody, including maybe even some of those farmers who doubted global warming. A couple of comments on the Dust Bowl. You know, we did see the plains largely plowed up to produce wheat. That was because of World War I. So we saw wheat acreage increase a lot to help supply the food for Europe. Unfortunately, once we hit then a dry spot, that land was very exposed in the 30s and related to the Dust Bowl. And I think a couple of things that have come up here with your listeners, as we have heard from Mark, land grants, USDA, farmers, and related people really took up that conservation flag, and we made a change. Now, also related to depression of the 1930s, if we go back, I think we had about 25% of the population back in the 1920s and 30s that was on the farm in the United States. Mm-hmm. Today, that's less than 2%. So if you think about how many people were related to farming, farming actually was in depression in the 1920s. Farmland values in the United States dropped every year from 1918 to 1932. So the old-time farmers always said the ag depression will lead the general depression. Hmm. I think the fallacy in that today is that we have the farm sector is now probably less than 1% of the entire general economy. That is the very tip of the tail. It's not likely to lead the general economy.
It has been a vibrantly healthy sector, though, as the rest of the economy has been pretty much in the tank. Does the drought this year end that, Chris? I mean, it's been very good years for farmers in recent years. Now what's the outlook?
Well, we have seen record farm incomes the last 2 years. We've seen record high prices of farmland, certainly in the Midwest and generally around the country. And the net worth position of farmers in general are better able to take on a perhaps tragic year like we see this year. Now, there are a couple of factors economically that will help crop farmers. One is that we do have higher prices, so lower yields if they have some yield, but maybe higher prices will help on their revenue some. Second important point is that we do have a very well-developed federal crop insurance program now, and we have to say that crop insurance is an election of the individual farmer. Mm-hmm. Some do not take the crop insurance.
They have to take it and pay for it. They have to sign
up for
it.
That's correct. Mm-hmm. Secondly, it is they have to elect the level. It's a high deductible. Generally, they elect 65 to 85% coverage. Common might be 75%. What that means is they take the first 25% of loss. But the bottom line, if they have at least an average level of crop insurance, they will farm next year where those who lose all their crop, they may have bet their entire net worth on this 1 year and can't survive it.
Yeah. Jonas in Pittsfield, Illinois. Jonas, thanks for calling.
Yes. Hi, Tom.
Hi, Jonas.
My question, which was just answered, was going to be how do the farm subsidies work? Because I know not too long ago the Corn Association was making a big push because they were looking at cutting farm subsidies. And then subsequently we have this major drought. And how, what is the impact if you have farmers that have taken out the farm insurance or the crop insurance?
Yep.
And how will it affect premiums throughout the whole insurance industry if they're taking a huge hit this year?
Let's look at that, Jonas, and thanks for your call from Illinois there. Chris, what about the difference between farm subsidies and crop insurance? Do they overlap? Are they entirely different things?
Well, there is a bit of overlap, but we will be writing, and I should say Congress will be writing a new farm bill for the 2013 crop. The current one expires at the end of September. One of the last direct subsidies that farmers were getting were called direct payments. Everybody in Congress, I think, and everybody in the farm sector expects those to go away with the new farm bill. It was about $6 billion a year that was going to farmers in direct payments. They essentially had to do nothing to receive those, and even farmers have admitted in today's budget environment that's not acceptable.
Mm-hmm.
Some of that money is going to get focused then on this safety net, and that is probably some type of enhancement of the safety net, of which the primary safety net has been crop insurance. So we think what Congress will go for is some kind of enhancement of crop insurance, maybe paying a bit more of those subsidies or giving them a bit higher coverage or some other form to try to make sure that farmers, if they elect that insurance, they can farm next year and not be wiped out of maybe three, four, five generations net worth in just one horrible year like we are experiencing in 2012.
Right now, and as you've pointed out, Chris, drought by its very nature is not a here today, gone tomorrow thing. Drought has persistence.
Well, that's right. And in the Eastern Corn Belt, we're generally 7 to 10 inches behind, really just during this growing season. to get out of drought, you essentially have to have fairly normal rainfall and then overcome those deficits. We're going to be in drought, at least by the definition of drought, right through the rest of this growing season and into the fall. And persistence is part of what a drought is, and we are in a persistent pattern.
Mm, a tragic year in big crop country there. Christopher Hurt, ag economist at Purdue University in West Lafayette, Indiana. We're very grateful to you for your insights this hour, Chris. Thank you so much for joining, and good luck there. Thanks for being with us.
Thank you.
And Mark Svoboda at the University of Nebraska-Lincoln, climatologist there with the National Drought Mitigation Center, monitoring program area leader. Mark, thank you very much for your insights today. Thanks for joining us.
My pleasure, Tom. Thank you.
Listeners, thanks for being with us. Good luck to all. I'm Tom Ashbrook. This is On Point.
On Point is a production of WBUR Boston and NPR.